Welcome. This is Casting the Pageant, Meeting the Characters of Christmas with the Reverend Dr. Alan Hilton.
All right, welcome to the fourth of our four sessions on Casting the Pageant, in which we've found our way back to the Christmas story through a different lens, through the lens of picking up the cast members, the people who make up the Christmas story, other than the babe whom we'll celebrate on Christmas Eve. There's a historical Jesus book, an attempt by a German scholar, creative German scholar called Gerd Thiessen, who wrote it in the 1990s, I think. And it was called The Shadow of the Galilean because he did a history of Jesus by all the perceptions of him that other people had. And so he featured the disciples in their various places in society, featured the Jewish leaders. This has been kind of like that. We've looked at all the characters who frame the coming of Jesus into the manger and into Christmas and into incarnation. And I hope you've enjoyed that way of doing things. Tonight, we move to the Magi. On the first night, we looked at three characters who are bit parts, cameo parts, Quirinius, Caesar, and that phantom innkeeper who may or may not have existed. The second week, we looked at Mary and a sideshow of the angels. Last week, we looked at Joseph and his choice, Joseph's choice. And this week, we turn to the Magi and Herod. We will also pick up, if the Magi are audience to Jesus, are people who can testify to the birth because they actually come and see the Christ child, so are the shepherds. And so we'll pick them up briefly tonight, having not done them last week. So with all of that as kind of introductory work, I want to begin by reading one of my favorite poems for this time of year. It's actually more suited to the early part of January when denominations around the world, Christians around the world, celebrate Epiphany, the day when we celebrate the coming of the wise man and the world getting an epiphany about who this Christ is. But I'll read T.S. Eliot's The Journey of the Magi as our opening tonight. A cold coming we had of it, just the worst time of the year for a journey, and such a long journey. The ways deep and the weather sharp, the very dead of winter, and the camels galled, sore-footed, refractory, lying down in the melting snow. There were times we regretted the summer palaces on slope and the silk sherbet. Then the camel men cursing and grumbling and running away and wanting their liquor and women and the night fire going out and the lack of shelters and the cities hostile and the towns unfriendly and the villages dirty and charging high prices. A hard time we had of it. At the end, we preferred to travel all night, sleeping in snatches, with the voices singing in our ears, saying that this was all folly. Then at dawn, we came down to a temperate valley, wet below the snow line, smelling of vegetation, with a running stream and water mill beating the darkness and three trees on the low sky, and an old white horse galloped away in the meadow. Then we came to the tavern with vine leaves for over the lintel, six hands at an open door dicing for pieces of silver, and feet kicking the empty wineskins. But there was no information. And so we continued, and arriving at evening, not a moment too soon, finding the place. It was, you may say, satisfactory. All this was a long time ago, I remember, and I would do it again. But set down this, were we led all that way for birth or death? There was a birth, certainly. We had evidence and no doubt. I had seen birth and death, but had thought they were different. This birth was hard and bitter agony for us, like death, like our death. We return to our places, these kingdoms, but no longer at ease here, in the old dispensation, with an alien people clutching their gods. I should be glad of another death. T.S. Eliot sees the shadow of the cross over the manger. He sees the frankincense and the myrrh, which are embalming spices. He sees in the manger scene that the Magi approach from their long journey. He sees indications of the cross, and he sees the Magi coming up against that call to a new life after an old death. It's a powerful poem, and it's worth your reading many times, I think. But for tonight, it's an inroad that reminds us that the story of the journey of the Magi in Scripture has been taken in many directions by many different people. It's so mysterious and interpretable, and at wide spans of interpretation, that people have felt free to let the legend accrue. And we have hymns about three kings rather than the Magi, who could have been any number. We have names for them. We have all kinds of traditions about how one was a king of India and another king of Persia and another king of Arabia. We have all kinds of accrued legend through the interpretations that have come over history. Tonight we get to go back and see what Matthew thought of it. See how this entered the story through this gospel. And see what we come away with on this Christmas Enosh. This Christmas Eve, 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 Eve. So let's pray for some help, and then we'll rock on. Will you pray with me? Our God, you're good to give us mysteries. We feel drawn into them. We feel compelled by them. And so we ask you to shed light on this one, mystery of the Magi. Give us eyes that see and ears that hear, we pray in Jesus. Amen. All right. It is great to see you. And starting with kind of a death message, when we're nearly celebrating a birth, may feel a little grim to you, but then there's the actual picture of T.S. Eliot, and that's awfully grim, right? He doesn't look so jolly. As Kelly told me in our run-up before we opened the room, he looks a little sour. And so you can see why he might have gone to the cross instead of the manger as a primary focus from this tradition. But tonight we're going to ask ourselves what Magi would have meant to the people who first received Matthew's gospel. How would they have heard this story? And what things might have stood out to them about it? And then we'll back off to the Magi and ask ourselves, how does that matter for us? So we start with that tradition that I mentioned, that Caspar is the king of India, Melchior is the king of Persia, Balthazar is the king of Arabia, and we get all kinds of glorious art. I'm going to share some of it tonight. But that's, of course, part of the accrued tradition. And we're back to the pageant that we began with on our first session, with the Magi in the way back. We were stunned by this pageant, kind of overwhelmed. It's hard for anybody who has kind of the usual small church pageant or something that's less robust than this. But in the back row, way at the top, under the palm trees, we see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 Magi. And they remind us that the passage will only give us the term Magi and not three, even though there are three gifts. We also get here young women magi. Magos, the Greek word, actually is a masculine, but part of the mystery is that this is wide open. I love that this pageant producer interpreted with A lot of, I think there were more women to cast, probably more young girls to cast, but whatever led to it, it's great to have some female magi under the palm trees back there. But let's go to the word and ask ourselves what magos means. Its first meaning in the Brown, Drivers, and Briggs Greek lexicon of the New Testament, which is a dictionary of Greek, is usually Persian or Babylonian, Eastern wise man or priest who was expert in astrology, interpretation of dreams, and various other secret arts. Second is a little more direct, a magician who pulls off stunts and wonders that are either mysterious or dark. And when we get to magician, we are reminded that one culture's miracle is the other culture's magic. That's a long ago realization by cultural anthropologists that it depends on which side of the line of in and out you are, whether your thing is actually miracle or sorcery, magic. And these guys come from far and they come into a culture that actually has a history of suspicion about Eastern magicians. And to remind us of that, I have one of the passages you were assigned in your preparation. Don't feel bad if you didn't get there, but I wanted you to have a shot at it if you had the time. There are others, and this is in a book called Special Laws by Philo of Alexandria. Philo is a very educated Alexandrian Jew who helps the people around him understand Judaism. And here he's talking about some of the special laws within Judaism. There are others also of the greatest wickedness. It's in a series of vices and things that are defined as vices in Jewish law. There are others also of the greatest wickedness, men polluted both in hands and mind, who, being sorcerers and poisoners, devoting all their leisure and all their solitude to planning seasonable attacks upon others, who invent all kinds of contrivances and devices to bring about calamities on their neighbors. On which account, Moses commands that poisoners and sorceresses shall not be allowed to live one day or even one hour, but they shall be put to death the moment that they are taken, no pretext being for a moment allowed for putting off or delaying their punishment. For those who attack one openly and to one's face, any body may guard against, but of those who plot against one secretly, and who disguise their attacks by the concealed approaches of poison, it is not easy to see the cunning beforehand. Do you see the suspicion here that the outside culture is magician magicians, the people from the other place whose magical devices strike fear into some Jewish tradition and makes it its way into Jewish law. So we're dealing with mysterious characters who may be, for some of Matthew's audience, negatively symbolized. They may have a negative association for Matthew's folks as they are first hearing the gospel read out in a living room somewhere in Syria, which is where most often they're placed as an early Christian community. So, if Philo gives us some sense of the ambivalence about these characters, and by the way, this is a sort of classic Persian rendering of a magician, a Persian magos. Then let's turn to the story itself, having prepared ourselves by giving ourselves a little ancient contemporary view of the ambivalence that Jews had toward foreign sorcerers. In the time of King Herod, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, magi from the east, and you'll notice my use of red tonight. I'll get to why I'm using it, but for now, just put up with it, I imagine. Magi from the east came to Jerusalem asking, "Where is the child who has been born king of the Jews? For we have observed his star in the east and have come to pay him homage." Now, when King Herod heard this, he was frightened, and all Jerusalem with him. So, this is the presenting issue that these magi bring. We get them after they've already reached Jerusalem, of course. T.S. Eliot's poem imagines them from the very start of their journey and tries to get into the difficulty of it. But this, of course, begins in Jerusalem with the presenting issue, which is these foreign dignitaries, these foreign mystery men have come in regal dress. We don't know. We don't know how they presented themselves, but they come asking a very regal question. Where is the child who has been born King of the Jews? For we observed his star in the east and have come to pay him homage. Now, false magicians were a dime a dozen, but ones who could divine things that actually happened were highly prized. And here you've got men who are claiming that by astrology, by their practice of discerning the mysteries, they have discerned that a king of the Jews has newly been born, and they've come to give him gifts, come to worship him. So, King Herod, if your name is King, as King on the front of it, and somebody comes and tells you with some authoritative voice, we just learned that a new king has been born. And by the way, if you're Herod and quite paranoid about your power, you get frightened or disturbed or troubled, which is what this Greek word behind frightened means, and all Jerusalem with him. Now, this one gives me pause a little bit. If we're learning about the Magi tonight, we learn about them from the way they impact people. And in Jerusalem, hearing the words, your newborn king has come, how do we find where he is? Could and might should, I'm in Texas, so might should is a thing, could and might should actually produce in you some sort of expectancy or desire or excitement, right? Hearing the newborn King of the Jews has come might actually lean you forward, but the characterization of their response, Herod and the whole city of Jerusalem, is they're frightened, troubled. So does this have to do with the fact that the Magi have reputations, right, that we talked about from Philo's laws? Is this because they're feared sorts or frightening sorts? It may be. But what we don't see in the population or in the ruler is the desire to receive this newborn king. Instead, this concerns them. So let's go forward in the familiar scene. Again, tonight, I give you images from different cultures of this scene. Here is one from Asian culture, the Adoration of the Magi. And we'll just continue with the passage here. And calling together all the chief priests and scribes of the people, Herod inquired of them where the Messiah was to be born. And they told him, in Bethlehem of Judea, for so it has been written by the prophet. And you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who is to shepherd my people Israel. So, what have we had so far? We've had this exotic crew, don't know how many of them, show up in Jerusalem, go to the palace itself, and ask, so where's this King of the Jews supposed to be born? We saw his star, but we need to know where is next. And everybody's troubled. But in their trouble, they go to their magicians. We'll call them priests. They're people who can look back at their old writings, the scriptures, and tell them how this mystery goes. And of course, the priests come. It's Bethlehem of Judea, for the prophets have written, and you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who is to shepherd my people Israel. So do you see how the narrative has the people fearing another culture's way of discerning what's going on, namely astrology, and turning to their own culture's way of discerning what's going on, which is prophecy that was written beforehand. One culture magic is another culture miracle. One culture's fan, and these cultures clash in the scene that we are so accustomed to watching in the Christmas pageant and reading and hearing the story of on Epiphany. Then Herod secretly called for the Magi. So here we've got the king who is now asking the magicians, asking the foreign astrologers, the dignitaries, the discerners of dreams, all those things. He learned from them the exact time when the star had appeared. Then he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, "Go and search diligently for the child. And when you have found him, bring me word so that I may also go and pay him homage." When they had heard the king, they set out, and there ahead of them went the star that they had seen in the east until it stopped over the place where the child was. So, more stargazing, more following of the star. Notice Herod's positioning of himself. He says, "I am a would-be worshiper. All you need to tell me is where." Of course, he is a paranoid despot. So all you need to tell me is where, so I can get rid of this child, is Herod's libretto, but he's showing a disposition to homage. When they saw that the star had stopped, the Magi were overwhelmed with joy. You would be too. It's a long journey. T.S. Eliot has let us in on that. On entering the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they knelt down and paid him homage. Then, opening the treasure chests, they offered him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they left their own country, left for their own country by another road. I love this art piece. It's by Laura James. It's called The Holy Family at the Nativity, but it's also got the wise guys in the background. This closing of the story, of course, introduces frankincense and myrrh, which were both used in burial practices, along with gold, which is a universal sign of homage and value, of course. And we also get a dream that the Magi now are going to have that will drive them a different direction back so that Herod's designs on Jesus's life cannot be carried out because they are not going back to report. And so, where have we seen dreams before in this story? Well, Joseph last week featured a dream, whereas Mary in Luke and Elizabeth in Luke and Zechariah in Luke all had direct angel visits. In the Gospel of Matthew, the characters receive dreams that prompt them to do things that are moving the story of God forward. So, what were angels as plot movers in Luke become dreams in Matthew. Joseph has one, and now the Magi have them, and later the Holy Family will have them again. Dreams are the movers of the plots in the Gospel of Matthew. So we get to the end of this famous story, and then, of course, what comes after it is heart-wrenching. Herod will, and we'll get back to this, but Herod will then, in his jealousy and in his paranoia, will, according to the story, kill all the infants under 2 years. Joseph and Mary will be fairly warned. We'll get to Egypt ahead of that slaughter, and then we'll return by a dream afterward. But we're going to sort of confine our attention to the passage that we've just read, those famous first 12 verses of the Gospel of Matthew. Because one of the things that we need to recognize is that if the Magi are brought to the scene of the manger itself, which is not mentioned in Matthew, by the way, it's sort of imported into our imaginations from the Gospel of Luke. If Magi gather to see the Christ child as observers, as homage payers, their partners are much lower on the social scale the shepherds who come from the fields at the behest of angels. Remember that? Not only Mary and Zechariah, but also shepherds get angel visits in the Gospel of Luke. And shepherds are not beloved characters or high-ranking characters in ancient culture. Aristotle has a somewhat damning appraisal of them in his book Politics when he's classifying levels of people. He says, in the lives of people, too, there is a great difference. The laziest of all are shepherds who lead an idle life and get their subsistence without trouble from tame animals. Their flocks wandering from place to place in search of pasture, they are compelled to follow them, cultivating a sort of living farm, right? If you're a shepherd, that's not exactly flattering. It's not something you'd put on your TripAdvisor or your app that would help people hire you for their sheep. And in Philo, we get another version of this that gives why somebody like Aristotle might not care for sheep, shepherds. When the king asks, "What is your occupation?" they'll answer, "We are shepherds, we and our fathers." If the discussion had been merely about the care of goats or sheep, perhaps these kings, these higher ups in culture that Philo is talking about, would have been ashamed to make such an admission. Oh, excuse me, the Jews might have been ashamed to make such an admission through desire to avoid dishonor, for such occupations are accounted inglorious and mean among those who are loaded with great prosperity, without being at the same time endowed with prudence, and especially among kings. So in other words, Philo in flowery language is saying, kings look at shepherds and think dung, right? Low, mean, inglorious. And it's because for Philo, who isn't so anti-shepherd, for Philo, shepherds are okay, but kings aren't endowed with prudence, which would tell them shepherds are necessary, and they do something good for the culture. These two passages, which are both from a little bit of a distance from first century Palestine, Aristotle, the 300s BC, Philo, sort of the century before in Alexandria, but they give us a general cultural take that shepherds are not the people you invite to your dinner party. They're not the people who are classed in society. If you're a person of some means or status, they're the low ones. And there they show up at the stable next to these dignitaries from the East, these magicians bringing very expensive gifts to this king, side by side. Now, if we're to ask what do the magi mean in the Gospel of Matthew, what do they do in the story, what do they bring? Let's go back to the genealogy that we traced over last week, just very quickly, to get to the strange ending: Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, who bore Jesus, who is called the Messiah. This week, let's look at a theme that runs through the condensed genealogy that Matthew gives us in chapter 1. Now, we did admit last week that the genealogy in Matthew is not exactly the most scintillating way to start a book, right? We will remind ourselves of that, but this is actually pretty fun. This is actually pretty striking, what we're going to look at now. Judah, the father of Perez. Now, I'm picking up mid-genealogy. The father of Perez by Tamar, right? Notice the name Tamar. Tamar appears as Judah's daughter-in-law who presents herself to Judah. This is Jacob's daughter-in-law. And presents herself, and in a famous story, she becomes part of the lineage of Jesus. Salmon, so she's Jewish, Tamar is, we think. Salmon, the father of Boaz, by Rahab the harlot, who is, remember when the Jews entered the land, Joshua brings them across the Jordan River. Rahab is the harlot who finds them lodging and helps them know what the situation is in Jericho. And this is the scene where Sunday schools have it that, the sort of march around the wall 7 times and the walls came a tumbling down. Rahab is the one who helps the Jews, and she is by no means a Jew. She is a Canaanite and is helpful to them and makes it into the line. Salmon, the father of Boaz, by Rahab. And Boaz, the father of Obed, by Ruth. Ruth is a Moabite woman, not a Jew, right? By birth or by religion, not a Jew. But she marries into Naomi's family and takes care of Naomi, her mother-in-law. And in the end, she is married to Boaz, who gives birth to Obed, who is within the line because next is the father of Jesse, Jesse the father of King David, right? Pardon me. Running a bit of a cold. Sorry about my voice. So it's very condensed, but here we have thus far Tamar, not an outsider, but a mistreated woman in the Hebrew scriptures. Rahab, a Gentile, Ruth, a Gentile, and now David, the father of Solomon, by the wife of Uriah, whose name is Bathsheba, she's a famous character in the story of Israel. So also probably a Gentile. So the nations have entered Matthew's genealogy, and since it's condensed and since it's selective, we should take them seriously. So there's much made of the fact that these are women and in the genealogy, when all it would take just by necessity is to name the father, 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 father. These are women who are brought into the story of the genealogy purposefully by Matthew to introduce outsiders who have been crucial to the coming of the Christ. And three of them are non-Jews from other nations. I don't know if you remember, we began our study by recognizing that Matthew is the most Jewish of the thought worlds of any of the four gospels. We picture a Jewish Christian community receiving this gospel, a community that is even still observing Sabbath, that is very conscious of law. When Jesus speaks his Sermon on the Mount, he's going to begin by saying, "You've heard that it was said, do not murder. I say, do not get angry." You've heard that it was said, there's a quoting of law. And in that setting, Jesus says, I have not come to abolish the law and the prophets. I've come to fulfill them. Right? Very much a congruent Jewish gospel, Jewish Christian gospel. But here we have this strange happening of three Gentile women being held up. And now we get to why I'm using red. It becomes a sort of red thread in this gospel that runs through the fact that in this very Jewish Christian community, Matthew's picture of Jesus, including our Magi for this evening, Matthew's picture of Jesus is a very international trending one. At the beginning, we get three international women as a part of Jesus's lineage, and then we get a visit of the Magi who come from, by tradition, India and Persia and Arabia, but at least from an international setting east of the Holy Land. Right? We get nations coming to the story in the earliest part, and the Magi become the epitome of that. Foreign dignitaries who come to the manger, nations coming to Jesus. Now let's see if that moves its way through the gospel. In chapter 14, Jesus, who has been preaching to Jews in Galilee, period, says, because of the increase of lawlessness, the love of many will grow cold, but the one who endures to the end will be saved. And this good news of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout all the world as a testimony to all the nations. And then the end will come. So if we began our story with internationals coming into it, whether through the genealogy or through the Eastern magicians and mystics, whose journey takes them into the story, this is an anticipation that someday all of this is going to go out to the nations, which are represented by this map that gets pretty close to what ancients might have thought was out there at the time of Jesus. What the world looked like, how far it would be to go to all the nations. Then we get in Matthew 15, the strange and wonderful story of the Canaanite woman. Here we get Jesus seeming not to have space or time for a woman who's not Jewish. Listen up and let's see what we make of it. Jesus left that place and went away to the district of Tyre and Sidon. That's north of Galilee, north of the land where Jews primarily live. So he's gone out of Jewish territory. Just then, a Canaanite woman from that region came out and started shouting, "Have mercy on me, Lord, son of David. My daughter is tormented by a demon." But Jesus did not answer her at all. Jesus is going to come off cold in this passage, just a trigger warning. And his disciples came and urged him, saying, "Send her away, for she keeps shouting after us." So neither Jesus nor the disciples has time of day for this woman. He answers her, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." But she came and knelt before him, saying, "Lord, help me." Have we had foreigners kneeling before Jesus before in this story? Of course, the Magi, right? Knelt before him matters here, saying, "Lord, help me." He answered, "It is not fair to take the children's food," namely the Jews, "and throw it to the dogs," namely the Gentiles, people of the nation. She said, "Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table." Jesus answered, "Woman, great is your faith. Let it be done for you as you wish." And her daughter was healed from that moment. Now, there are a lot of ways to read this story, but it sounds alien to the Jesus we usually think of. Jesus usually doesn't turn away the needy, right? But here, he just says, "Talk to the hand," to a woman who has an urgent need for her daughter. One way to read this is Jesus truly believes that he was only sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel when this story starts. It's very possible that he thought, "This is my mission. This is my, you know, it's kind of like my job description. Jews are the people I'm going to help. That's what God wants. That's what I'm up to." He runs into this woman. She says, he says, "You don't fit the category, so get away." And she entreats him, and something happens to his sense of his mission. It's possible that Jesus learns in this setting that his mission is bigger than he had perceived it to be, and he helps this woman, and suddenly, it's not just the lost sheep of the house of Israel. That's one way to see it. Of course, some people have trouble processing that way, because wasn't Jesus born full-grown from the head of Zeus? Wasn't Jesus born with all of the knowledge he needed to do everything rightly? How can we imagine the Christ learning from a woman from Tyre and Sidon? That gives some people pause and problem. And so those resort to a second reading of this, which is Jesus is testing the woman's faith. His silence is a way to slow the scene down and give her a chance to ask, "How much do I actually believe that this guy can do this?" When she finally shows her faith by kneeling and pleading with him, he recognizes it as faith, calls it that, "Great is your faith," and so grants her wish. Right? Some of you probably read it one way, namely, Jesus learned something. And others of you probably read it the other way. "No, I don't really think Jesus learned stuff. I think he knows stuff from the start. And therefore, I think he's testing her." Whichever way you read it, we have a movement from Jews out into the Gentile world. And by the way, the fact that he even took a trip to Tyre and Sidon might indicate that that was part of his design, right? They're outside Jewish territory. And so here we've got another kind of foray into the international, but the real clincher is if we start the gospel as we do, with a genealogy that brings outsiders in, brings internationals in, and a story of the Magi that brings internationals in, that have internationals coming toward the Christ. At the end of the gospel, in the famous Great Commission, we have Jesus sending his disciples out. And listen how that goes. Now, the 11 disciples went to Galilee to the mountain to which Jesus had directed them. When they saw Jesus, they worshiped him. But they doubted, and a better translation might be, but some doubted. This is, I think this is NIV translation. Should be, but some doubted, but they doubted. This is where it gets to the part we want to feature, though. Jesus came and said to them, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go, therefore, and make disciples of the lost sheep of the house of Israel." Is that what it says? No. Go there and make, therefore, and make disciples of all nations. The very nations that came toward Jesus in the manger now go out from Jesus, now become the objects to whom the disciples are going to take the gospel out, take Jesus out to the nations. So what started as a convergence of the nations now becomes Jesus populating the nations with this good news of his kingdom. Make disciples of all nations, baptizing them, and remember, I am with you always to the end of the age. All right, we are to our question and answer time, and it's time for Kelly to take the floor, and I think she may have an announcement or two.
So, Alan, the questions and the back and forth that we have that I want to get your input on is, okay, so if the Hebrew Bible had foretold of the coming of the Messiah, wouldn't the people of Jerusalem have seen the announcement of the birth as a welcome message, right? Especially after it was confirmed from the prophecies. And then Patricia said, when a people have found hope and comfort for generations in prophecies of an exalted leader to come, it's fairly typical human nature to experience some level of discomfort, even fear, to consider any suggested evidence that the prophecy is being fulfilled. What do you make of all that?
That's great. That's a good back and forth between the two of you on the chat page. Brothers Karamazov by Fyodor Dostoevsky is one of my favorite novels. In it, maybe the most classic or the most famous section is called The Grand Inquisitor, in which Dostoevsky pictures Jesus coming back into the church and the church rejecting him, the church hierarchy rejecting him, right? I have a feeling that that may have its origin, at least partly, in this story of the Magi, because exactly that conversation that you just represented, Kelly, that's in the chat, is the live question when we read that the foreign dignitaries come and say, we've seen the star. We know that the newborn king has come. All we need is GPS, right? All we need is to know the last bit of the directions. And they're probably very excited as they speak it. And the people get worried. Status quo is a tempting thing, right? Status quo is familiar. The things we're used to in religion, in church, in life, the things we're used to take on a status with us that doesn't want to be interrupted, even by great things, right? So the church misses Jesus in the Grand Inquisitor. The city of Jerusalem misses Jesus because nobody follows the Magi, right? Nobody in Jerusalem says, oh, well, I got to go see this. The Magi go alone to the stable, well, to the house in Matthew, and look in on the babe because nobody's that interested. That's a bad commentary on the Jerusalem of their time, but we just as we start to judge them, we can probably turn a finger around because you and I also like the status quo. You and I, when somebody starts shaking things up, often resist because, well, it's pretty good the way it is. I think this reflects human nature. as Patricia kind of wove in.
Okay. So this next one is about the star, right? So one question was, the Magi observed the star in the east and then come from the east to Jerusalem. If they saw the star in the east, then why would they have journeyed west to Jerusalem? And someone else said, I had the same question. But as I was reading it, I thought maybe it referred to the Magi themselves. They saw it where they lived in the east. And then someone else said, I heard that in the Greek, in the east and at its rising are the same word. So perhaps they saw the star at its rising. So what do you make of all of the directional questions?
Yeah, I love the way you all chat with one another. And I don't see it because I don't have chat open as I lecture. I would get too distracted because already I'm the kind of person who's, ooh, squirrel, you know? So we don't want to put chat up for me. But the discussion that you had, it introduces the solutions to this. It is either we saw it, we saw it from our location in the east, or we saw it at its rising, right? And so it's not the direction they're looking to see it, it's the place from which they're looking, or the time frame of the stars sort of appearing. And the folks who have read it as we saw it looking eastward, it's a confusing way to read it, but even they have a leg to stand on, because what's being told by the star is that the newborn king of the Jews is being born, right? The new king of the Jews is being born. The message of the star in their interpretation is that. So they know where the Jews live. They go west, but they need more guidance, and the star comes in to actually give that. It's a pretty freaky thing that a star gets that specific, right? Some have also, by the way, just to extend this question, some have also asked, obviously, astronomically, was there a strange heavenly appearance in this time frame? And of course, many possibilities exist, and the instinct to look for them is actually a pretty normal instinct. It's just really hard to identify. Remember last two times ago we had this problem with Quirinius and Herod. They never ruled at the same time, and Luke had them ruling at the same time. So we know we aren't dealing with gospels that are particularly adamant for keeping the time frames exactly straight, right? The Herod that we're dealing with here is Herod the Great, who died in 4 BC. So if all of this is dated to a time before he died, because he's the one who's paranoid about this upset, then Jesus would have been born before 4 BC, right? And so people look for the star there, or they look for the star on zero, or they look, and there are obviously a number of things that people look back to and say, it must be this, it must be this. And I feel about those kind of like I feel about Jesus's, you know, there'll be wars and rumors of wars. There are also always wars and rumors of wars. So it's a good cover for could have been the time, been yeah. The star, but we don't know.
Okay.
Another question.
Yeah, so were Jews or were they in danger if they traveled outside of kind of like the Jewish territories, like Jesus traveled beyond, right, to this area?
Right.
Or vice versa?
Yeah, so only by being aliens, and it depended on the territory. So there were places that were more or less amenable to Jews coming through. Samaria didn't love seeing Jews come through. And Jesus encountered Samaritans purposefully, right? So he went out riskily to Samaria. And we don't know what the disposition of Tyre and Sidon's population was toward Jews at the time, because we only meet this woman particularly. But yeah, it varied is the basic answer. And it varied for people going through Jewish territory, Right. The Jews were in Leviticus 19 enjoined to treat the alien as a citizen, for you were strangers in Egypt, right? It's in the same section as love your neighbor as yourself. But they didn't always, as we would guess, they didn't always keep that. And so sometimes they were harsh on people who entered their territory. All right. So in our last 5 minutes, I want to take you quickly to Herod. Because Herod's an important figure in this narrative. And if Herod, so you've been around people who are very comfortable with who they are, who are unthreatened by the possibility that somebody comes in to their work team, or pastors who, come into their church, associate pastors or guest speakers, or you've been around people who are confident in what they're doing. And so those kinds of things don't trouble them. They actually see them as enhancing. But you've also been around people who are threatened by somebody who might be good at what they do for a living, right? You've been around pastors who feel like they need to kind of grab their territory and make sure nobody likes that pastor more than me, or teachers who talk about the teacher down the hall in ways that are disparaging because they want to be held higher than that person. You've been around insecurity in leaders, just as you've been around confidence in and security in leaders. Herod was an amazing leader. Built, and he's the one, the second temple, the one that is sort of a revisiting of Solomon's temple. He built it up into a glorious, glorious temple during his reign between 37 BC and 4 BC. He did so many things that were evidence of great leadership. Augustus Caesar talked about him. He was that prominent. But he was also extremely, extremely insecure and paranoid. Here are some of the things he did in his paranoia. Herod put to death three of his own sons on suspicion of treason. He put to death his favorite wife out of the 10 of them. Mariamne was his favorite. She was a Hasmonean Maccabean princess. He put her to death. Then he killed his mother-in-law, one of his 10 mother-in-laws. He invited the high priest down to Jericho for a swim. They played a very rough game of water polo and they drowned him. He killed several uncles and a couple of cousins. At one point late in life, Herod plots and fails to kill a stadium full of Jewish leaders. Now, what does this tell you? It tells you that he's the kind of guy that if he heard from foreign dignitaries that a new king of the Jews had been born somewhere near, he wouldn't rejoice. There's nothing in Herod that had space for that. Now, the question, the historical question, whether Herod actually slaughtered the innocents is unresolvable. We don't know. It's never mentioned in any ancient sources outside the scripture. So is it something that Matthew is doing, putting in to characterize Herod, because we know how Herod is? He got rid of all the competition by slaughtering everybody 2 years old and younger just for good measure, just to make sure, right? In other words, is Matthew crafting a story about Herod that would fit people's imagination because they know the rest of Herod, but not something that happened? Or is he reporting something that happened? We don't know. And there are people in this room, in the Zoom room, who probably read it each of those two ways. I mentioned Austin Farrer's words last week that he said about miracles, what I would say about things like this. It may have happened or it may not have happened, but one thing to remember is God's the only author who's ever been able to write with history. So the line between literature and history gets kind of rubbed away when the author is able to make miracles happen, to make history happen. Matthew may be reporting or he may be creating. Either way, we get a vivid image of Herod as a despot who doesn't want a piece of anybody getting any power in his region. So the Herod who's presented in Matthew is very aligned with the Herod we know from everywhere else. He's the last of our characters in the pageant. We've now touched all the bases. And we close then with this scene, the last scene again, where the Magi gather in front of the Christ child and have finally arrived. When they saw that the star had stopped, the Magi were overwhelmed with joy. On entering the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they knelt down and paid him homage. And then, opening their treasure chests, they offered him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they left their own country by another road.
Thank you for joining us. Please visit us at yalebiblestudy.org.